Hello and welcome everybody to the masterclass tonight, August 17th, 2023. We have some great presentations tonight. That's going to be great. I do have a one that's going to be a person is here, and then I have a couple recordings that we're going to run through. So this should be really interesting on what we're going to cover this evening. I really look forward to it. I'm sure you guys do too. Alex, you go right ahead if you are ready.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Let me just make sure that everyone can see. Can you see my screen?
I see your TCW dash. There you go. I see it. Data privacy.
Okay. Might be a little bit delayed, so I'll try to work with that. Well, good evening, everyone, and thank you for taking some of your time to listen to me talk about something I'm very passionate about, and that's data privacy. And so in my presentation tonight, I'm going to talk about several topics ranging from what is data privacy to the laws and regulations about it here in the United States, as well as we'll get into some examples, and of course, I'll have some questions at the very end. But all right, so to start off with, what is data privacy? Now, privacy is recognized as a human right, and information data privacy is a subset of the broader right to privacy. And really, that's only found in the democratic governments of the world. And it relates to an individual's ability to determine for themselves how and for what purpose their personal information is handled by others. So you may be asking, okay, so why is data privacy so important? And of course, the importance really stems from the ability to ensure that the human autonomy, dignity, safety, and self-determination, and really, data privacy is the right to privacy that is also recognized as an enabling right because it facilitates the enjoyment of other human rights, such as the right of freedom of expression, freedom of thought, conscience, religion, freedom, assembly, association, and the right to be free from discrimination. So in this way, it serves as a foundation for the government and our society that we live in here in the United States. And if we look at some examples of privacy policies from, I just chose several large companies. And what you're looking at is the word count of some of their privacy policies. And some of them I was able to capture a then and now type of picture. And what you're looking at is privacy policies that are 5 or more years old versus the privacy policies that are now. So by no stretch of the imagination, you can see that if you're interested in reading a small book, you can happily read these privacy policies and get lost in these. And so, for example, so I'm going to look at PayPal and iTunes. You can see that organizations have more recently worked over the years to simplify their privacy policies. However, many of their privacy policies, the way that they separated them is they shortened them down, and instead they've separated certain areas of their old privacy policy into maybe sub policies like data processing policy and other similar policies, which may have all been grouped together under, in the past, under the organization's one privacy policy. And more recently, Facebook, as an example, I know Meta, right? Facebook Meta rewrote its privacy policy to a secondary school reading level. But when it did that, it also tripled its length. And so now when you think about privacy policies and all these apps, a lot of time apps and services, a lot of times you're questioning, if the app or product or service, if it's free, nothing is really ever free, right? So if the product or service is free, then it means that you are the product or service. And the big question is, what does that really mean? So as individuals, as we're navigating through all these companies and we have all these multitude of accounts online, and we're reading these privacy policies, whenever there is a service that free, you have to realize that you are the product or service. Now, One thing to kind of take note is that, you know, a lot of times when talking about privacy policies and the type of things that companies do, many people will say, well, you know, I don't have anything to hide, so it's not really that big of a deal. But if you really think about that statement, in my opinion, I think it's really an indication into that person's simplistic view of their data and the data that their companies are collecting on them, and overall the lack of maturity, I would say, in understanding what these companies do with the data and how the data is collected. So, for example, this is a quote from a New York Times article, and they were quoting Johann Kasper, who's the Data Protection Commissioner of Hamburg, Germany. And this person said that Facebook, as an example of a company that collects data, provides a network where the users, while getting free services most of them consider useful, are subject to a multitude of non-transparent analysis, profiling, and other mostly obscure algorithmic processing. And I'm sure everyone in this meeting knows, but an algorithm is simply a step-by-step process or a set of instructions that describe how to perform a task, and it's pretty regular in computer science. And so you might be asking yourself, okay, so as you visit all these different websites, you go on social media, you log into Amazon, you know, basically do what we do from day to day, you might, okay, what is really collected about us? And these are items that I pulled straight out of Facebook's privacy policy. And maybe think for a little bit, let some of these things set in. So it's information and content that we personally upload, information about our social networks and our connections, our usage, the transactions that we make on this platform, but not just us, things that others do and provide about you. And then they also capture tons of different things about your devices, device attributes, operations, hardware identifiers, signals, all different type of settings. They also collect network connections, such as IP addresses and cookie data and information from all the different partners that Facebook associates with. And if you think that that's maybe a little bit concerning, Facebook also develops profiles for individuals that are not on their service. So you might say, well, not a big deal. You know, I don't use TikTok or I don't use, you know, whatever. But a lot of these companies are developing profiles that are not on their service. There's also other things that they capture, right? They capture camera data, like for your mobile phone, microphone data, photos, your contacts. They also capture the GPS location while you're using their services, and not just on their direct website or their direct app, also on their partner apps. So you'll know that, you know, in Facebook, for example, you can do pixel tracking code, part of a marketing campaign. And so if someone adds that pixel tracking code to their website, well then, hey, that website just has become a partner app. And then all the metrics of that website and usage goes in and gets collected and tracked. And so now, as I dug deeper into privacy policies and done research, the biggest thing that I found, and that I think everyone would agree, is that even though companies are making efforts to simplify the language of their privacy policies, the understandability of their privacy policies is not really the big problem. The big problem is just that users, individuals that are using these products or services, are just being overwhelmed by the language, overwhelmed by the length, and overwhelmed by the types of things that maybe to the uneducated person that doesn't know about technology, the types of things that these companies are collecting. And so according to a survey collected by addictivetips.com, 87% of people accepted privacy policies without reading them. And they, at the time, this was just in the last few years, they identified that TikTok, WhatsApp, privacy policies were by far the hardest to understand. And some interesting things about those is that TikTok's privacy policy requires a reading age level of 17 plus years old, so very technical. But TikTok as a social media platform has a sign up age of 13 years old. So the minimum age you have to be. So you see there's some discrepancies there. you have to be 13 years old to sign up, but really only 17 plus years old adults would be able to understand the language of those policies. So on average, if you look at all the social media privacy policies, they take over 47 minutes to read fully. And that's on average. So 47 minutes to read. And there's a number of sections that are perhaps more complex, and I'm not going to bore you with those, but 47 minutes to read. So coming up just shy of an hour to go through and read the privacy policies. And so as part of that same survey, the respondents responded to a bunch of different questions. And some of the stats from that was that 89%, so about 90% of those that participated, say that privacy policies were too long. Over 80% said they would consent either way, whether they read it or not. And over 70% said that they were just not able to understand what they were reading. So you can kind of see that there's kind of a systemic problem with IT companies, social media companies, and the users of those products and services not even reading, let alone trying to understand what's really happening as they use those platforms. So I wanted to just talk about kind of the current state of data privacy. And kind of the big problem with data policy, the data privacy, is that the way that it is works here in the States is that businesses try to get consent. They try to get informed consent if possible. But what they're really doing is they're pushing, I would say, there's a business culture of risk transference, where they're trying to transfer the risk of if there's some type of data breach or what they do with the data onto the consumer and just say, well, hey, you agreed to use the service or product, so it's on you. So it's kind of a way for them to cover themselves instead of actually maybe do what we would think is right and protect individual privacies. There's also kind of an all or nothing type of mindset where you open up your new phone or you open up a new app and it's an all or nothing mindset, meaning do you agree to these, you know, conditions and services, or if you disagree, then you may not be able to even use a platform or service. So there's not many, and companies, I would say, probably over the recent few years are getting better, where they're allowing you to select individually. It's not like an all or nothing, but many companies still operate with that all or nothing mindset. And there's still an issue, though, where even though that some of these companies are allowing better customizable selections for their data collection settings, their privacy settings, those are not turned off by default, like the privacy and the sharing, the collection. So what needs to happen, or what ends up happening, is it's on the consumer, the individual who uses the platforms of service, to try to figure out where that's at and then turn them off itself. The businesses obviously don't, and they do that for a reason. But now, according to Ashkan Solanti, who's now an independent researcher, but he used to work at the Federal Trade Commission, he said that most people believe that they're protected, meaning their data that's being collected on them, their profiles, their information, until they're not. And again, that's Ashkan Solanti. He used to work for the Federal Trade Commission. So I want to talk a little bit about the laws and regulations, and really what you're going to see is that the European Union has the GDPR, which is very comprehensive. They just passed it in the last few years, and it is very encompassing in the ways that it protects individuals' data privacy. And of course, many businesses are having to adjust to that if they do business with citizens of the EU, which people could be traveling all over. And so they're trying to adhere to that standard. California also has a standard CCPA, but the federal government, unfortunately, here in the United States, does not have a singular law similar to the GDPR that covers the full spectrum of privacy. And instead, the U.S. government is comprised of a mix of laws like HIPAA, FCRA, FERPA, GLBA, and all these other acronyms. We can talk about, there's many of them. There's the Privacy Act of 1974, and that primarily governs how federal agencies collect and use data. So it's not talking about private organizations. HIPAA, which is was passed in 1996, that, as many will know, kind of really focuses on the medical records. The Gramm-Bialich Act was passed in 1988, and that's more focused for financial institutions. There's a Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, that was passed in 1998, and that limits what companies can do with the data that they've collected about children who are under the age of 13. And I mentioned the California Consumer Privacy Act, CCPA, which is passed in 2018. So there's several states that are passing similar laws as California's Customer Privacy Act, such as Virginia, Colorado, Connecticut, and Utah, that may go into effect later this year. However, the vast majority of states here in the United States do not have specific data privacy laws. And the data that's collected by a majority of the organizations in those states and throughout the United States, most of it is not as regulated as you might think. And so as we can see, there seems like there's some pretty big gaps in the federal privacy laws that regulate many companies. And so unfortunately, what that means is that many organizations, if they're not constrained by their local level state laws, they, you might say, have free play to do what they will with the data. And there's not a lot of controls and penalties, you know, if they mishandle that. And what does that really mean? That means that they can use, share, sell that data that they collect online about you without notifying you what they're doing. There's no national law that that standardizes privacy, data privacy. And the big question that I would pose to the group here tonight, or if you're listening to this, is what is really needed to ensure the privacy of individual consumer data? So let me kind of look at just some recent examples, and you may kind of give you some pause here. So just recently in 2019, the Federal Trade Commission fined Facebook $5 billion. I couldn't, you know, it's hard to fathom what that really is, but that's a lot of zeros. And you'll see that this is the highest penalty in the privacy arena for privacy enforcement actions that the FTC has ever fined a company with. And ironically enough, they fined Facebook because Facebook in 2012 was also investigated by the FTC. And as part of that investigation back in 2012, they did not follow the order and then instructions that the FTC had provided about data privacy. And so when they basically, FTC came back at them in 2019 and found that they were just running wild and not doing what they're supposed to. And that's when they said, okay, here we have to issue this fine. Now, maybe to Facebook, $5 billion is, I don't know. I'm not going to even guess. 1%. I don't know what their quarterly revenue is, but that's a lot of zeros. And in the news article from the FTC, they said that Facebook failed to submit to new restrictions, and they had to submit new restrictions and a modified corporate structure that will hold the company accountable for the decision it makes about users' privacy. And so they agreed to do that and to provide that fine to settle the Trade Commission's charges from the company. So, you know, many of us, like I mentioned earlier, we kind of use all these different platforms. We use Amazon, we use Venmo, we use all these different social media platforms, and we kind of hope that these companies are doing the right thing and respecting individuals' personal privacy. But we see from this fine, and I think if we really look closer, that companies are maybe not towing the line as much as what we would really like. And so this is more of a question, a rhetorical question. Which companies do you feel treat your data privacy the best? And I listed a few, there could be many others. Hopefully you've enjoyed this topic. These are my references. Like I said, I feel strongly about data privacy. I do feel that that it is a right, and it does allow us to express ourselves in our own way. And if those expressions and that information that companies are collecting about us are those companies are not really treating that the way that they should, then it seems like there's some pretty big gaps in our current society that that need to be filled. And of course, I think that there's ways that they could be, but when there's a will, I think there'll be a way. So thank you for listening. Happy to answer any questions. And that's what I have for tonight.
Excellent job. Very good. This was a great point to make, because a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of people who don't even think about their privacy or understand how it works when it comes down to it. And all the data that gets taken from us. And where? Does anyone have any questions for Alex?
I think for me, I was surprised, because I was thinking, well, I'm safe because I don't use a lot of these different social media platforms. But I was surprised, maybe, but maybe more shocked to learn that Facebook develops profiles for people that are not even on their platform.
Yeah.
And of course, the reason that they do it is they categorize you and they put you into different categories and to sell ads and things like that. But I don't know, that's a little, it starts to get very touchy if the company is doing that, and who has access to that data, and, you know, what are their opinions that their algorithmic models have developed about you, and sure, what you'd be willing to absorb. So, you know, I think the argument of hey, it doesn't really affect me, and like, I'm not really on it, is kind of a very, it's nice to feel like laissez-faire, like I don't have to worry about it. But the reality is that, you know, like it or not, this is what's happening.
Yeah, exactly. So, you're more a part of it than you think. Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If your friend's on it, you're on it.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, it is creepy. That's right, Rebecca. Absolutely. Well, no, great job. Excellent work. Well, like I said, I don't think Tamara's going to do hers this evening. I think we had switched times and I didn't keep up with it. But I do have one from Lindsay Loans that I will be showing. So let me get the... recording started. Make sure it's all going to work correctly. Tell you that on over here. Okay, can everyone see the screen?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Let me move that out of here. All right. All right, let's get started. I haven't used this one in a while. It's full screen. There it is. Okay.
Hi, my name is Marian Lindsay, and today I will be talking about styling the home, in particular for yourself. What I'm going to touch on today are important things to keep in mind before you ever think about designing a space. the necessity of having inspiration and how it can affect the outcome of what you are going to have. Things to keep in mind when you're buying furniture, accessorizing, and I'll particularly touch on maximalism versus minimalism. And then finally, how scents can affect a space and those in it. Some things to keep in mind are when you are decorating or furnishing, whether it be a new or existing home, something you shouldn't really do is follow trends solely because it's a trend in the moment. Something you really need to think about is if you love the trend and you love how it looks genuinely within you, if you love it, then use it. If you don't, follow your heart and, going to my next point, style for yourself. Don't style for what a potential future owner or tenant might like. Putting that potential person's interest in mind above your own makes it a lot harder for you to love your space while you're in it. When it comes to inspiration, you can either have what you see on screen, which is called a flat lay, or you can have a mood board. Either help, both are good. And both of them, what they'll do is show you, this is sort of the tile, this is the sort of fabric, the sort of accessories that I want in the space, even going as far as furniture, particularly frames, which I'll touch on later. And even down to art, what kind of art do you want in the space? What kind of rugs do you want in the space? These all, whether it be mood board or flat lay, they help you really see the bigger picture of what your space is going to become. When it comes to furniture, personally, I have a lot of experience with CR Lane, as that's what my current job really sells, as we are their number one retailer, at least in the US, if not beyond. And with CR Lane, you really want to think about things in at least three stages, if not more. You want to think about your frames first. What kind of piece are you going for? Are you going for a sofa, a sectional? Are you going for a recliner? Do you want it powered or manual? Or even, do you want a chair that's just a chair? Do you want it to swivel? Or do you want it to be sort of like a rocker chair, which is what they call gliders? And that's all something you should keep in mind. And even down to dining chairs and bar stools, they have a lot of really good options. And after you think about the frame and what kind of style you want to go with, then you want to think about patterns. And when I say patterns, I don't just mean plaids and stuff like that. I mean solids, and even leather is considered a pattern really to them, to CR Lane. So you really want to think, do you want to do the classic Czech plaid? Do you want to go floral or damask? And damask is basically just a floral. The Wilder Woods desk that you see on screen is actually an example of a damask. Do you want to go solid? And do you want it just to be that solid color? Or do you want it to be a velvet or a mohair, which a mohair is a type of short velvet? So do you want that? Or going on further, do you want leather? And with leather, they have a ton of different finishes. It's practically like another type of wood almost. And with leather, you can have the Arizona cactus you see right above Wilder Woods, which is sort of that green color, or you can go with a more classic brown, which I don't remember off the top of my head what that Herringer has, but that sort of classic brown leather color is something that you certainly can do as well. And it really is something that you have to think back to your inspiration, your flat lay or your mood board. How have you decided you want to have the space look? Do you want it to be more of a rich and luxurious feel, which to me screams sort of leather or a rich velvet, I guess, like a dark velvet almost? Or do you want it to be more light or even more modern and go with a geometric pattern and stuff like that? And then finally, the third stage that you really have to think about with, at least particularly with Sierra Lane, is the finishes of the wood. And it's not something people think about right away, but finishes of wood, I don't just mean on a dining chair or something like that, where you're primarily potentially going to see just wood. I mean, even on that CD 8800 series sofa, those wooden legs, those are a particular finish that you really want to think about. And if I had to guess, the Nathan Power recliner might actually have the driftwood finish that you see on screen right now. So you want to, in the same vein as your patterns, you want to think what kind of wood accents, if you're going to have more, or accents in general, do you want in that space? And think about, do you want that lighter driftwood birch look, or do you want to go more rich and do a tavern black or mahogany, and that rich color is what you want? So it's really something where you're having that inspiration really affects the outcome. Next to think over is accessorizing, and this should really come after you've done furniture and potentially after a good chunk of time. In my mind, you should really, and this is something that people especially recommend with art, but I think overall in general, is you should really start minimal. You can have maximalism eventually if that's what you want. You can have any other type of accessorizing if that you want, but you should really start minimal, as when you think minimal, you think clean, you think functional, and then you also want to think, if I'm going to accessorize, it's going to be, as it implies, minimal, but also intentional. And so you want to have that beginning because it helps you see in the long run, well, actually, this is exactly where I want this piece of art to go. I thought I wanted it maybe in the next room, but no, I want it right here. It helps you determine, this is the type of floral I want either year round or seasonally. And so that's really why you should start minimal. And I don't just mean as these pictures imply, I mean, you can start with color on your walls. You can start with color on your furniture. That's not a bad thing. Minimalism is not all stark white IKEA like minimalism. That's not necessarily what it is. But you can start there and either stay there or go to the maximalism. And with maximalism, it's, although to some people it looks clutter, you really want to think clusters with maximalism. You want to think every little nook and cranny is a spot to design. It's a spot to make an arrangement of some kind, which is why maximalism really isn't talked about that much, as not many people think about that. But it's fun to do and it's fun to have, especially around seasonal times as we're coming up to. Finally, we are wanting to think on the impact of scent and how it can really affect the people within a space, as well as just the space in general. You can have maximalism galore and have it to the point where it almost is clutter. But you can still have the space feel right to you. And scent is the best way to really go about doing that. The ones I've listed, citrus, peppermint, lavender, and sage are some good examples of particularly focusing on mental health, but you can also have cinnamon. Cinnamon always draws you to fall and Christmassy, so that's a good thing. It's also just a really rich and the closest word I can think of is full. It's a really nice, full, rich scent to have. But citrus, some of its properties are getting you alert and energized, which is really helpful, like in the mornings, especially if you're not a morning person like myself. That's when that really helps. Lavender will help you more at night as it really soothes you and tends to help you get to sleep. And it also, if you have headaches or migraines, which let's be honest, we work in an IT field, we're going to be staring at screens all day for the rest of our lives if we don't already. And that's something that you really want to keep in mind, because that can really cause you to have headaches and migraines. Even if you do the best you can to prevent them, whether that be blue light glasses or whatever, looking at the screens all day will affect you, whether you want to admit it or not. And lavender will really help soothe that and decrease the stress and tension that all of that is putting on you. And peppermint is good, similar to citrus, for energy, but it also helps clear your mind and stimulate thinking. So it's probably a really good one to have like while you're working. That way you can have that clear mind and get through issues and problems that you might be experiencing in your code or in whatever you do in your IT field. And then sage is almost, the benefits are almost a amalgamation of lavender and peppermint. It has that mental function and productivity boost, but it also is a really soft scent that'll help you sort of relieve at least a little bit of tension and calm your mind down quite a bit. Unfortunately, that is the last I have for today. And as you are watching this video, I am actually done with my internship. So I can't answer any questions, but these are some really good sites to look at if you're looking into furniture. CR Lane is an amazing retailer, and they have amazing customer service and everything. And that is all I have, but I hope you all have a great rest of your internship. And as you're in masterclass, I know you're aware, but make sure you sign up for your masterclass if you haven't. Thank you.
Well, that was a good one. That was a good point of view on setting up your rooms, your apartments, your offices, whatever that might be. I like it. Okay, now I have. So this is something that we are doing, that I've started doing. If we can't find a time for you, and of course, that's why we say set your time up as soon as possible before your term ends, so that you can get a presentation. If we can't find a time for you, because sometimes it runs too many, we have six, that's an hour and a half. You know, if we have eight, that's 2 hours. I think that's going to be quite a lot. Yes, masterclass. So what I'll do is I will get your recording and then I will show it at another time. So that way it is still part of it. As long as I get your presentation, you still get credit for it. But, and then we get to still hear your voice even after the fact. So I'm going to go ahead and start Mason's. And can you see his slides here?
We can.
Awesome. Looks like NMAT. Let's get started.
Hello, my name is Mason Leslie. I am a cybersecurity analyst intern, and my presentation is over NMAP. So NMAP is a network mapper. It's a free open source tool used for network discovery and security auditing. NMAP can be used to scan host networks for open port services and sometimes vulnerabilities. NMAP is important because it can be used to identify hosts and service on a network. It can find open ports of potential security vulnerabilities. It can test firewall and intrusion detection systems. And you can plan security audits and penetration tests with NMAP. So NMAP uses a variety of techniques to scan hosts and networks. Including ping scanning, which sends an ICMP echo request packet to a host to determine if it is up and running. Basically, NMAP will use this, the information it receives back from the host when it sends these packets, to determine the information it gives you. It also can use a TCP SYN scan, which sends a TCP SYN packet to a port on a host to determine if it is open. It can do UDP scanning, which sends a UDP packet to a port on a host to determine if it's open. But there's many different types of scan options and many different commands you can use with NMAP. You can control the timing and control how long NMAP waits for a response from a host or port. You can send custom data to a host or port with the payload options. And you can allow NMAP to detect operating system with a couple different commands. So, NMAP, like I said, has a lot of different use cases. So it can be used for network discovery to identify hosts and services on a network. It can audit your security. So you can scan a network and all of the hosts and see what ports are open, and then use that to potentially find security vulnerabilities. You can use it to test the firewall. For example, if you're trying to scan a host, your firewall should drop, you know, depending on your configuration, it should drop some request which would return a closed or down port for NMAP. So that it can be used to test if your firewall is actually properly. And you can use it for penetration testing. Basically, you can use all the information you're gathering from your scans and determine how you want to try to penetrate a network. So NMAP is not a perfect tool. It has limitations. It was developed long ago. I don't remember the exact year, but the concept still works because of how our networking protocols haven't changed a lot. So, but it can be blocked by firewalls. It can be detected by intrusion detection systems. And then, you know, dropped from sending packets. And it can be used by malicious actors to attack networks. So, encryption, Nmap is a powerful tool, and it can be used for many different purposes. And it is important to use Nmap responsibly and ethically. Nmap should not be used to attack networks or systems without permission. All right, so what I have here is a a scan using the Zenmap application, which is just the GUI version of Nmap. Just makes things a lot more, you know, easier to read and understand and visualize a lot better. But you can see here, we ran a quick scan. And we put the target in here, and then it basically just generated the command, which would be the same command that we would use in the command line version. But, you know, for example, we could run that same command, and you can see it starts out starting Nmap, just like this one. This is just, like I said, visualized better. And then it also will give you more information. I also did a intent scan, which is why we have so much information on these different hosts. So you can see that that was this here. It takes a little bit longer. It's louder. A firewall or intrusion detection system on the target may pick up on it and drop all requests. But you can see here, you can click on the device and it'll take you to that part of the scan. You can also break it down by ports and go through here each and look at the open ports. You can also look at the host details. So we can start up here. For example, this one, it gives us the MAC address, tells us the operating system right here with what it believes to be 88% accuracy. But you can go through here and you see like this one, for example, is Apple Mac OS. So I know that that's one of the MacBooks on the network. Here's some more. A lot of Android devices. So you have another Mac OS device. So with this one right here, we have claims it's a Windows XP device, which I know is not accurate because this is a VMware virtual machine on the network that is. I don't have any XP, but it determined, which, you know, just goes to show it's not completely accurate, but, you know, I could, wouldn't take me long to figure out which one of these it is. Yeah, that's the example here. And then just to show you the terminal version, let's see. There we go, just completed. So, like you said, it's the same output as far as the terminal side, but this is a lot harder to read than the Nmap output on this side. Like I said, this is highlighted with ports. You can go through and find the bolded IP address is a lot easier than this. But that kind of covers that. Like, again, you don't want to scan any network that you don't have written consent to scan, because then you can get into some legal trouble. But yeah, there's, hopefully this goes to show why this program is still being used by security analysts today, even though it, you know, it was created decades ago. So, but that concludes my presentation. Unfortunately, I'm not able to attend live, so I'm not, you know, there to answer any questions. But if you do have any questions, feel free to reach out on Teams, and I'll get back to you as quick as I can. All right, thanks.
Hi, my name is Varian Lindsay.
Hold on, let me get rid of that one. Well, those were a couple of excellent presentations, I'll tell you. Information I did not know on end mapping. So I was wondering about that, since we do have a cybersecurity department. I always wonder what those guys are doing back there, you know, with their end mapping and cyber and stuff. Other than that, if you have any questions, you're welcome to reach out to them, ask them any questions you might have, and I look forward to checking out you guys' presentation when the time comes up. And thank you so much for joining, and you have a great rest of the evening.